The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
We often find in Buddhist practice a kind of skepticism about concepts. You know, we often hear just be with the experience. But I've found in some instances, concepts really allow me to understand and articulate my experience, even to myself. And one such concept is moral injury. This is something I've been thinking about for the past couple of months, especially. It's a concept that was formulated after the Vietnam War to explain the situation of many veterans. And this is the definition of moral injury. Moral injury is the damage done to one's conscience or moral compass when that person perpetrates, witnesses, or fails to prevent acts that transgress one's own moral beliefs, values, or ethical codes of conduct. I'll read it again. Moral injury is the damage done to one's own conscience or moral compass when that person perpetrates, witnesses, or fails to prevent acts that transgress one's own moral beliefs, values, or ethical codes of conduct. So it's not only sort of actively doing something that is in violation of your own moral concept. Sometimes it's witnessing something that's so damaging. Sometimes it's failing to prevent. This was most acute after the Vietnam War. People found that they were unable to protect their comrades. In some cases, people found it really hard to reconcile the killing of civilians, and especially women and children. And this concept has been expanded a lot. So in healthcare, for example, in the beginning of the COVID pandemic, you know, when things were so frightening, that there were, some healthcare workers had to weigh whether or not they would continue to provide care to patients or whether they would not practice because they had family members who were extremely vulnerable, immunocompromised. I mean, this is just a terrible, moral dilemma. That first most awful year of COVID, when people, the staff at a hospital, they were unable to let a family be with a dying person, which was just, again, transgressed all the sorts of care that they wanted to offer. In sort of contemporary circumstances, when a caregiver, a healthcare provider, can't provide the treatment that is necessary for a person because of financial reasons or because of insurance issues, or in veterinary healthcare, for example, one of the great in areas where we find people suffering from this sort of moral injury is when a veterinarian is asked to euthanize a pet, either because the owner doesn't want to pay for the care and the treatment, in particularly if it's something really serious, or in other cases that the pet owners just don't have the financial resources to care for it. So the veterinarian is asked to put down an animal who otherwise could be brought back to health. So in 2020, for those of us living here in Minneapolis, the police murder of George Floyd resulted in severe moral injury to the actual people who witnessed that murder. The young women, the people who were there standing on the sides, begging the officers to, Officer Chauvin, to get off George Floyd's neck. Severe moral injury. They're unable to prevent something that transgressed their moral beliefs, their values, their ethical codes of conduct. And for the hundreds and thousands of us who witnessed that tape, there was often also a kind of moral injury. I'm just feeling that as taxpayers, we supported a system that went amok in such a terrible way. The feeling that we this was so much against our moral code. We witnessed something that was against our moral code. And the common responses to moral injury are things like guilt, shame, disgust, isolation or alienation, feelings of unworthiness, untrustworthiness, and the inability to trust others in these really severe cases of moral injury. And what I want to suggest tonight, I mean, I find this such a potent concept, but what I want to suggest tonight is that many of us suffer from what I would call chronic low-level moral injury, that we end up participating in racist systems, that we end up benefiting some of us from white supremacy. For example, the land and labor theft that occurred in the past and actually continues into the present. Our participation in climate degradation and in the exploitation of animals. You know, that there's often, and it's not to say that we endorse these sorts of things, but we find ourselves in systems where we're often implicated, where we find ourselves complicit with situations and with systems that actually go against our moral compass. And I think this is a particular kind of suffering. When we are out of alignment with our values. And again, I think in many cases, you know, we're doing the best we can, whether we are, you know, sort of paying an honor tax, for example, to the Dakota for the land that we're inhabiting, whether we're working with anti-racist groups, whether we are trying really hard to use resources wisely to, you know, recycle, renew, but we find ourselves that we know that we're in these systems where we're kind of out of alignment. And I was thinking about this, that it's kind of like having a chronic low-level inflammatory response. You know, that sometimes we have the sorts of injuries where there's just a kind of chronic inflammation. And it's manageable, it's low level, it's not the biggest thing in our lives, but it really impacts the quality of our lives. You know, makes us cranky a lot of times, which I think is sort of one response to kind of chronic moral injury, is a kind of crankiness. You know, that in the metta practice that I do regularly, there's a phrase I use, May I be free from all inner and outer harm. And, you know, this is a kind of harm, our complicity with systems that we don't like, that we would want to change, that we know are harmful in many ways, even though sometimes while we're benefiting from it, you know, that we, we can continue to fly on airplanes, and we know that airplanes are a real pollutant. You know, it's not a huge big deal, but I know a lot of people who get on an airplane and maybe pay a carbon tax, and but just don't feel great about air travel. And there's a lot of stuff. Well, this is it's useful to take this trip. I mean, you're always kind of balancing off the benefits and the harms, but recognizing that there are harms in a lot of the things that we do. And it's not that we can, no one of us gets out of here not doing harm. The inevitable harms we bring to one another, we bring to the planet. But the response, I think, to this kind of chronic inflammatory kind of low level moral injury is either to deny it, like really try to ignore it and deny it and just say, I can't do anything anyway. This is how it is. I can't make things different. I'm just stuck in this system. This is how it is. I'm not responsible. I'm not, it's just, or deny actually, which is even more interesting. Deny that there's any sort of chronic inflammatory moral injury, like I'm okay. Things are okay. That sort of tamping down, that kind of denial where we're tamping down our discomfort all the time. Another way is just to acclimate and normalize and to say, this is the way it is, always been this, people have always exploited each other. There are these inequities, that there's a way of just normalizing it and letting it go, refusing to feel the pain, refusing to feel the discomfort. It's interesting that Thich Nhat Hanh, the late great Vietnamese teacher, in response to the climate crisis, said something very much like, and this is a paraphrase, because I didn't go back and look at the documentary that he said this, but he said something very close to the most important thing to do with respect to the climate crisis is to feel the pain of the world. That's the most important thing to do. So one of the things that I'm going to suggest about, sort of our recognizing our kind of chronic moral injury is to, how do we work with this? How do we work with witnessing, being unable to prevent, even if we're not perpetrating? And lots of times we are witnessing or we feel that we are able to prevent these kinds of harms. And sometimes people say, well, moral injury is just moral distress, is another kind of word for it. But I think it's more than just distress. I really do think of it as a kind of injury to one's conscience, to one's values. And I think the first thing is to recognize it, to really see those arenas in which we find ourselves feeling implicated in the sorts of systems that we participate in. And just to name it and understand our complicity, just to understand how a system works and how we're in it. And when we do that, I think the other thing to remember, and this is what I think is most important about us as a species, is that we are an incredibly caring species. I mean, that's the most important, I believe, the most important thing about us as human beings is that we are a caring species. And, there are other caring species, especially other primates, but we're a species that can care not only about our own kind, our own families, people who look like us. We can care about other other species. We can care about all kinds of animals. We can care about future species, future beings, that we have this incredible capacity to care. And none of us would be here if there weren't other human beings who cared enough about us when we were infants and toddlers to keep us alive. We're only here because of care. And that's the most important thing about us as a species, I think. And I think that's something to really remember when we're looking at this sort of chronic moral injury, is to remember, we feel this because we are a caring species. This is why it hurts. This is why it is this constant gnawing kind of thing, because we really, really care. And that's really a wonderful thing, to care so, so deeply that we can admit the discomfort of our participation in these systems. And one of the responses to this, I would suggest, is to get really good at practicing self-compassion. And self-compassion is this, attuning to our own pain, and being able to do something about it. And in self-compassion, and this is something that is taught here, Jean Haley and Jane Rauenhaus teach self-compassion. And if people are just interested in looking it up or listening to it online, the person who really developed this is Kristen Neff. And you can find lots of podcasts and information about self-compassion. But the first step in practicing self-compassion is to recognize the depth of our own suffering, not to minimize it, not to compare, not to say, but my life actually is pretty good. So, you don't minimize, you really pay attention to the depth of your own suffering, why this is painful, why this hurts, how much it hurts. And then the next step is to realize that there are many other people suffering in exactly the same way. And what's so brilliant about that, I think, is not that it minimizes our own suffering, but we know that our suffering is really legible to other people who are also having this same kind of suffering. It's why meeting in support groups is so helpful, because you go and you meet with other people who recognize your pain, who know what your pain is, and they really can understand you. They can understand this kind of pain. So in doing self-compassion, we recognize that there are others, so we don't feel so alone. One of the responses to moral injury is to isolate, to feel alienated, to feel separate, to feel that there are people who can't be trusted. So in doing self-compassion, where we recognize that other people feel the way we do, that they have the same heartache, that they're doing the best they can, but the climate is degrading so rapidly. So realizing that you are not alone. And then the third step in self-compassion practice is to bring mindfulness and loving kindness into your life, to really pay attention to the present moment, really be aware of your own moment-to-moment experience, not to gloss over, not to deny, to really be present, and to be present with a kind of warmth and tenderness toward yourself and toward all other beings. Now, one of the challenges sometimes in learning to do loving kindness is, and loving kindness in one tradition, you know, starts out yourself. It's supposed to go from persons who are easy to persons who are, you know, pretty easy to do it yourself, easy to the difficult. But sometimes people really find that it is really challenging to offer genuine kindness, concern for, and sometimes I think of loving kindness as like a wholesome concern for one's own welfare in the deepest sense of welfare. So in doing loving kindness practice, what we're often doing is trying to maximize the conditions under which we can feel genuine tenderness toward ourselves. Because that's what we would like to have, a genuine tenderness toward ourselves. And when we do that, and we can kind of hold that and hold the discomfort, the inflammatory response to moral injury, I mean, that's kind of the challenge, to hold both of that. This week, I was listening to a Dharma talk by Sylvia Boorstein. And for those of you who don't know her, she is sort of the California Vipassana, truly Jewish grandmother. She is someone who just brings such authenticity and wisdom and complete pragmatism to her practice. She's a very deep practice, and she was a psychotherapist. And one of the things I love best about Sylvia, whom I don't know personally, is besides she has a metta happy birthday that goes to the happy birthday song. A student from Stanford asked her in an interview, you know, so you do all this meditation and you try to cultivate your mind. So what do you want your mind to be like? And Sylvia said, I want my mind to be like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And, you know, like everybody's welcome. Everybody gets listened to, you know, King Friday gets to be King Friday. Daniel Tiger gets to be kind of scared. Daniel Tiger, everybody's welcome. I thought, that's so brilliant. Like what, you know, a mind like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And Sylvia gave a Dharma talk in the past weeks. If you go on Dharma Seed, you can find it. And it was really in response to what's going on in Israel and Gaza. And she said, you know, as an American Jew, there's just so much heartbreak, so much suffering everywhere. And she said, there is nothing left to do but be kind to yourself and everyone else you meet. And she thought this was not a trivial response, this sort of impartial kindness. What you can do in response to this tremendous suffering is to really commit to being kind to yourself and everyone else you meet. And I've been thinking about this for the past couple of days, because I listened to the talk maybe 3 or 4 days ago. And I thought, well, you know, I'm a pretty kind person. You know, this is good advice. I'm a pretty kind person. And then I realized today that I was thinking about two kind of spiritual podcasters. And in my own mind, I was just being so snarky about them. Just so judgmental, so snarky, so I'm not going to tell you what I was thinking, but it was really snarky. And it just occurred to me, like, why aren't you kinder to those persons? I mean, like, as if they knew me, right? This is just sort of my own little, sort of mental drama. I just thought, they're doing the best they can. They mean well, they're doing the best they can. They're helpful to lots of people. Be kind about it. Don't just be so snarky and critical and you know, in your own mind, know, give them a really snarky review. So, and you know, I mean, it just, but it was something that I thought, oh, I'm such a kind person. And I thought, well, not really, you know, here's this kind of stuff that goes on. And couldn't I decide? Couldn't I manage to hold that kind of view? Or a friend of mine that I was talking with about, a Dharma friend, talking about what was going on in the Middle East, said, you know, people are just so enraged and so hurt that they're not able to take a larger perspective. That there are times when people are just so overwhelmed by something that you can't say, well, those are children. She said, no, all you can do is to kind of hold their rage and their anger and understand that right now they're not capable of anything else, so that your job is to be more capable. Your job is to hold a bigger container. And I thought that that was such a wise and compassionate, you know, and you know, if you've had experiences yourself of rage or being around rage, people are just so over the top, so angry that, you know, you can't reason with someone who is over the top angry. You know, you can try to deflect them maybe, but you can't reason with them. And that, you said, no, that our job around people like that may be just to take a bigger perspective. Say right now they're not capable of anything else. Whether that's, you know, you might not think that's correct, but it to me it was really interesting to say, oh yeah, this is rage, and right now like that fire is burning. So practicing radical kindness and compassion. It's kind of that no one thing is, I believe, no act is too small. You know, people say, well, there's nothing I can do about it. And I think, is there something little you could do? No act is too small. And another thing we can do to practice this sort of radical kindness, compassion, is to stay present. And I read an article by two retired bioethicists a year ago. It's called Six Maxims for unsustainable world, but it was a radically altered, essentially unsustainable world. And one of the things they said that bioethicists learn is that even in the most awful situation, in a situation where there is going to be no good outcome, an outcome that none of the outcomes are the outcomes that anyone desires, they said, there is almost always something that can be done to make it less awful. And that includes staying present, not abandoning people. And they talked about sort of as medical doctors, sometimes when, you know, like terrible decisions are made in the neonate ward and there are no good outcomes at all and stuff that no one wants. And he said, you can make it less awful by staying present with people, by not abandoning them. And I think this is something to really take to heart, not abandoning people, bearing witness, being willing to hold the difficult and the complex, seeing both the micro and the macro, being willing to be vulnerable. I mean, these are all things that we can do that actually are practices of radical kindness and compassion. And I think we can also cultivate friends who are willing to explore chronic moral injury with us. Friends that we can really talk with about this in a very deep way. so that we can all do what we can to act more in alignment with our values, even if we can't extricate ourselves from the system. And I would also, I think it's really helpful to nourish our aspirations. You know, when we do the metta practice, we have this ultimate aspiration to be completely free from ill will. And ill will is essentially wanting to harm another for the sake of harming. So we have this aspiration to be free from ill will. And I think we should all just cherish our capacity to care, and as best we can to feed that capacity, to let it grow and grow and grow. Now, we may not be able to cure chronic moral injury. We may all continue to live in systems that are in some ways an affront to some of our deepest values. But we can work with it skillfully, and that we suffer less when we do that. And when we suffer less for the benefit of all beings. And that's really our aspiration. So that's what I have to offer this evening. And I would truly welcome any responses, questions, observations, your own experience with moral injury or that you've heard of. And you can either, I've got a mic here, if you want to say it from the room, I can repeat it, or if you're willing to come up here, I can give you the Zoom mic, or if you are in the Zoom room, you can just unmute yourself and speak, and I think everyone will be able to hear you. So, and it's always an act of generosity to share. So I encourage you. Is it Sam?
Yeah. Well, thanks for naming something that I've experienced and articulating it so well. I think that for me, I've suffered the isolation from moral injury and haven't been able to articulate it for a long time. And, you know, I've been working on awareness and compassion and for myself. And I think that what I've been doing without being able to articulate it as well, you know, earlier now that I hear this, it occurred to me that what I've been doing is scanning my situations in the moment and certain things that I can have, I do have the capacity, the bandwidth to address in the moment. I do take action. They might be small things. You know, like signing a petition, which I did earlier today. You know, I was feeling pretty helpless in some certain, circumstances. But daily, several times a day, I try to scan myself and the situations in the present moment and find ways that I can take action and what I'm capable, what I have the capacity to do in the moment to, alleviate that suffering, and it changes daily, my capacity. Sometimes the only thing I can do is rest or take non-action, and that is beneficial as well. And someone that, like myself, who I've in the past been really highly reactionary, taking the moment and taking non-action was what I was capable of doing. So doing that scanning and taking the time to be self-aware has allowed me to find some peace and diminish some of that injury. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Sam. It is this idea. I mean, that's mindfulness essentially, checking in, being mindful, seeing what's going on, and sometimes restraint. Sometimes rest. Really, it's paying attention to what's really skillful in the moment, and doing what you can. You know, as I said, no act is too small. Other ideas or responses? Anyone online want to say anything? Anyone in the room? Eric.
Thank you so much for tonight. Very much appreciated. There was so much you said that really struck at my heart. And I've been feeling very, very vulnerable for quite a long time, the last several months. And I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, as you practice, you become, and your heart becomes softer, you feel it more, and you're more aware of the suffering that was always there, but not that you weren't aware of. What I found, you know, in the current heaviness of the world is being less reactive, being more compassionate, being more realistic, being more kind to people. As you say, people who are feeling so much in so many different ways, and just saying, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're expressing your feeling. But it is a difficult and newer thing for me to be as present as I am to that suffering within myself and within others. But this whole thing of kind of low level moral injury is something I really want to explore in my practice.
Oh, thanks, Eric.
I don't know exactly what you said, Patrice, but there was something about like attending to and being intimate with our own suffering. And
can everyone online hear or not? You can't. Okay, great.
And yeah, I just want to echo how I feel like for years and years I did not believe that I deserved to feel my pain. I felt that I was too, like, that my positions of privilege meant that, you know, there's more pain out there than what I was feeling, and therefore I should not feel like I should not take the time or the space or attend to these things. And that didn't make me more capable of showing up. It just made me less capable of being with and being with the suffering of others, and really like deeply less capable. Like it actually makes empathy impossible, at least for me in my experience. And it fostered for me this sense of just a real inability to witness others or be with others in their pain. So I just want to share that experience, and that what you said resonated with me in that.
And your name again?
Anders.
Yeah.
Yeah, Anders.
Anders.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anders. That's really a wonderful insight, that when we're unable to acknowledge our own pain, when we discount it, when we minimize it, we are much less able to be genuinely responsive to others. Thank you. Anything else?
Patrice?
Mm-hmm.
This is Rosalie. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Rosalie.
I also really loved your comments, and it is a super useful framework. So I'm really appreciative of you offering it. I was thinking of the companion. It reminded me a lot of Ton Glen practice, where you work really deliberately with pain, and it helps you to, I don't know what it helps you to do, but it seems very related to this as a way to work deliberately with this step one of paying attention to the depth of your own suffering. With that practice, you know, you just take in the pain or the negative or the hurt, and you breathe it back out. And it's just been, could be a really good companion to the self-compassion, I think. I was just wondering if you had ever noticed that, and thank you.
I didn't make that connection, but certainly the Tonglen practice is of being able to breathe in and accept suffering and then breathing it out. And often Tonglen is suggested that people do it when they're pretty steady and pretty balanced, that sometimes taking on suffering, if you're not resourced in a way, taking on the suffering of others, if you're not resourced, can be really challenging. But there is this, that what you're pointing to, I think, is sort of developing this capacity to be with suffering. You know, that really is like the first noble truth is there, we encounter suffering in life. And so developing the capacity to be with suffering, I think almost paradoxically, really develops the capacity to be with joy. So I'll end tonight with a little prayer that my friend Larry Yang is the one of the founders of co-founders of East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland. And he wrote a wonderful book called Awakening Together. And it's about community and spirituality. So and this is his metta prayer from Awakening Together. He says, may I be as loving in this moment as possible. If I cannot be loving in this moment, may I be kind. If I cannot be kind, may I be non-judgmental. If I cannot be non-judgmental, may I not cause harm. And if I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least amount of harm possible. And I think this is a very pragmatic aspiration that that sort of recognizes the struggles some of us have. So Sylvia can, you know, say, you know, always be kind. Sometimes it's really a challenge. Sometimes what we are just kind of going down and down, what is possible? And sometimes what is possible is, may I cause the least amount of harm possible? And that's a worthy aspiration. So I'll share the merit, and then I think we've got some announcements. So if there's any goodness to our practice, any benefit or blessing or merit, we would gladly, happily, joyfully share it with others. In fact, if we could, we would give it all away, every bit of it. We would share any blessings with our teachers, our parents, our families, our friends, our community. We would share any goodness with the people we like and the people we don't like so much. We would share any blessings with the people we know and the millions upon millions of people that we have yet to know. And in addition to all the two-leggeds, we would share any blessings with the four-leggeds, the many-leggeds, the winged, the scaly, the slimy, and the finny. May all beings find a path to peace. May all beings be free from suffering. So thank you all for your sincere participation this evening.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.